Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. The symptoms of Lyme disease are so like almost all chronic illness that it's often missed as a diagnosis. In fact, it's thought that most people with chronic fatigue, Parkinson's, diabetes, psychiatric symptoms, and body-wide pain may have been bitten by a tick. Since some people don't develop the classic bullseye rash, diagnosis of Lyme may be delayed until the standard tests no longer track its progression. Something of a new popular diagnosis, most conventional docs don't think of testing for it. More daring integrative practitioners are treating aggressively, also sometimes without testing or without comprehensive testing. It's not so easy to test. Today we'll explore the complexities of discovering and treating this singularly invasive spirochete in the hopes that many debilitated patients can take advantage of the varied treatment options available before they become chronic. I'll be interviewing immunologist Dr. Nick Harris and Cindy Quattro, who is a licensed acupuncturist and a physician's assistant. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. I'm always attracted to issues in environmental health, not least because ecology was my first academic love. And so, two news items caught my eye last week. The first was a study by researchers at USC that found fine particulate air pollution is much more damaging than previously thought, causing chronic illnesses like heart disease and diabetes at four times the rate previously thought. The California Air Resources Board is set to examine this and similar studies and is likely to tighten standards further on the internal combustion engines that power cars, trucks, and trains, which are the principal source of fine particulates. The second item was a report by the National Research Council recommending that the safety standard for naturally occurring fluoride in water should be half its current level. The so far sacred cow of fluoride added to water by cities was not in question, but the results of the council's review should up the ante on that concern. Previously, the standard was 4 parts per million. The council recommends that a safe dose occurs only below 2 parts per million. That's not far from the 1 part per million for city water supplies. The EPA requested the review in order to set new standards. In both cases, the conclusions were the result of statistical analysis. They looked at how different communities were affected by different levels of exposure. In the case of air pollution, the researchers looked at how many people developed chronic illnesses. For fluoride, they looked at how many people suffered bone fractures and similar conditions. Here's an important point. Not everyone who was exposed fell ill. At low levels of exposure, only the most susceptible people suffered. With a little more exposure, less susceptible people were affected. What does susceptibility mean? It means your body's ability to restore the balance that is disrupted by an environmental assault, whether it's a toxin or a pathogen or an allergen. In an article I wrote recently for the Progressive Health Observer on the increasing prevalence of allergies, I discussed how the increase in asthma and other hypersensitivities is likely due to a degradation of our immune system. I also discussed the environmental factors that might be making it harder for our immune systems to restore balance when assaulted by an allergen. Are air pollution and fluoride like the allergen? Most of it more of a trigger for more people? Or are they environmental factors that affect our susceptibility and make it harder for our bodies to restore balance? When I work with people, that kind of question is always in play. Do you maintain and restore health by reducing exposures or by supporting your body's ability to stay in balance? The right answer, of course, is to do both. How much of each depends on your unique biology and your unique circumstances, also known as your environment. So when news comes out that a safe level of fine particulate air pollution or naturally occurring fluoride or any other environmental assault has been established, I have to think, safe for whom? That a statistical difference can't be found doesn't necessarily mean that no one is affected. For a copy of this transcript, go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and go to the radio show page. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Fawcett. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, a writer, and a health educator. He works with individuals. He also is the executive editor of the Progressive Health Observer newsletter. You can reach him by going to our website, where you'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer or consultations. You can call him at 707-874-1496. The website again, yourownhealthandfitness.org. A brief announcement before I introduce my guests and our topic. Dr. Fawcett and I will be doing the first of a series of public health education courses on Saturday, April 22nd, from 11 a.m. to 1:30 at the Occidental Center for the Arts, called All the News That Doesn't Fit: How Challenging Health Myths Can Save Your Life. We'll be talking about the dose makes the poison, bad science behind attacks on nutritional supplements and hormones, with special emphasis on cancer prevention, and also turning symptoms into diseases, how contemporary health science and practice have created diagnoses like metabolic syndrome that turn healthy people into patients. Saturday, April 22nd, 11 a.m. to 1:30. Ticket information is on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Now to our topic for the day, Lyme, why, whether, and what to do. And let me introduce my two guests who are with me today. Cindy Quattro, Quattro, is a physician's assistant and practices complementary medicine for more than 20 years. She is a licensed acupuncturist, and she's currently a doctoral candidate in acupuncture and Asian medicine, specializing in chronic illness. She has a family practice for the last 10 years in the Santa Cruz area, and we are very happy to have you join us today, Cindy.
Hi, Lena. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hi. You're going to have to speak up just a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can adjust that.
That's good.
Better?
That's much better. If you're on a headset, you might want to switch to just the handset of the phone. We're also joined by Nick Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S, Ph.D. Dr. Harris is a board-certified immunologist and is currently the president and CEO of Igenics Reference Laboratory, which he founded in 1991. Dr. Harris did his undergraduate training at University of Wisconsin, his graduate training in anatomy and immunology at the Medical Center, University of Illinois, and his postdoc work was in transplantation immunology at the University of Minnesota. He was an associate professor of surgery and biochemistry and chief of transplant immunology at the University of Texas. He then moved on to Bioscience Laboratories in Los Angeles to head the immunology department. Following that, he joined 3M Diagnostic Systems as a technical director and headed product support, clinical studies, in the reference laboratory. Dr. Harris has over 100 publications in immunology and Lyme disease. He is an active member of multiple societies, including the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. That website is ilads.org. We'll have all these links to various websites on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Welcome to you, Dr. Harris.
Good afternoon, Lena. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. one of the things that I think we should start with, I think that many people listening to the show are somewhat initiated into the topic of Lyme. It's been such a hot topic lately, not just here but everywhere. We might want, though, to roll it back for just a moment and explain why it is that we're so concerned about this spirochete. So I might ask either one or both of you. It's often compared to syphilis, which, as people know, if it's not treated early, causes a number of very, very dangerous effects in the body. How is this like syphilis, and what are the dangers of late treatment?
Well, some of the problems, Lyme has been called the great imitator because it imitates a lot of other diseases. Oftentimes, it starts with flu-like symptoms and can disseminate, like syphilis does, into the other organs, and there can be cardiac abnormalities, neurologic, or even psychiatric abnormalities due to the spirochete. It can look like lupus. Many patients often will get a diagnosis of MS before it's realized that they really have Lyme disease. So it can hide and look like many other diseases, and it can affect most of your organ systems. There's been reports of changes in the eyes, skin lesions, as we mentioned, the heart and blood vessels, joints. It can affect the lungs and liver and cause muscle pain. So it really has a wide breadth of symptoms, but it can start very simply and not look like very much in the beginning.
Yeah, it also seems to cause a sort of metabolic syndrome-like problem where people have high blood sugars. Cindy, my understanding of Lyme is that the actual creature, the spirochete itself, literally spirals into the tissues, into your organ tissues, and that's one of the reasons it's very hard to eradicate. Is that a correct way of describing it?
I think that's what makes it unique, is the nature of its morphology. It's basically shaped like a loosely wound corkscrew. That's why it's called a spirochete, and it can dig into the tissues, especially where there's a lot of fluid, such as larger joints and the mucous membrane lining of the digestive tract. I've seen it with a lot of chronic sinusitis, and I think it's also because this spirochete can dig itself through the mucous membranes, and it can also cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the nervous system and affect the neurons there. So it makes it much harder to eradicate.
Now, clearly, some people get bitten by a tick. They may notice a rash. Some people are lucky enough to grab the tick and put it in a plastic bag and have it tested. They go to their physician. They get treated with a standard series, just like a one, like a 10-day or something, of doxycycline, which is a relatively mild full-spectrum antibiotic, and they never look back. It's over with. Other people immediately get ill, very ill, and continue to be ill and have to be treated for a very long time, even if they discover it early on. What's the difference here? What causes that to be so different in one person versus another? Either of you can answer this.
Well, obviously, the immunological health of the patient is going to have a major influence, as well as other things that may be going on. A patient can be immunized by being bit by the tick and having the spirochete in their body and protect themselves until there's some sort of event that triggers it, and that event may be a flu, it could be an accident, and just could be their overall health.
So, Dr. Harris, am I right in understanding you that you are saying that somebody can go a long time without symptoms, but are you saying that some people, if they don't have some kind of immune assault, will never have symptoms?
I don't know that never is valid. Mm-hmm. At least for a period of time, they won't have symptoms.
But I would say also that the immunologic status of the individual who's exposed is going to make a big difference in how well their immune system knocks this off.
That's correct.
Certainly, in the literature, it appears that people with thyroid disorders or other sort of autoimmune problems with a hyperimmune-activated sort of immune system are going to be more at risk. So people who have a tendency toward chronic illness will be more at risk. Cindy, are you not utilizing a brand new test to check to see the status of somebody's T helper cells or killer cells?
Yes, there is a test. I wouldn't say it's brand new, but we are using it more regularly now. It's a subset of the T cells, or more accurately, the natural killer cells called the CD57 cells. And we're measuring this as a marker to determine immune status. It's still an investigative marker at this point, but it gives us an idea, or it's an indicator of how the course of treatment is affecting the patient. It also may give us an idea of their prognosis. I think genetics play a large role in the individual efficiency of the immune system for each immune response for each patient. And I think some of these markers may control how well the body detoxifies, too, which has
certainly
an influence.
Yeah, well, in fact, one of the ways that the spirochete attacks people is through, it sort of hoses up their detox pathways by producing a lot of fat-soluble neurotoxins. So it screws up the liver, basically. That's not a very scientific term, screws it up, but I think people get it. And so you get, you know, a more susceptibility to poisoning. So it would make sense that if somebody is deficient in folic acid or can't utilize folic acid properly, which could be a passed-on trait, they would be more at risk of getting this. And that makes sense to me because there are a lot of things that make people's detox pathways not work, whether they have a genetic predisposition or not.
And I think that's why we need to treat more holistically and address the detoxification pathways of the body as well as just try to eradicate the toxins.
Yeah, and just to be clear, when people hear that term detox, they usually think that we're talking about coffee enemas. And while that may be used by some alternative practitioners, the truth is that detoxification is primarily a nutrient a deficiency problem where there aren't the right chemicals for the body to produce glutathione.
Yes, and so we add nutritional supplements that help the liver to do its job better.
Now, what you know, one of the let me just quickly ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Cindy Quattro, Quattro. She's a physician's assistant and a licensed acupuncturist. And Dr. Nick Harris, Ph.D. from Igenics Laboratory. Part of the inspiration for doing this show was that I have heard from various patients who were very grateful for the test that Igenics has done, and they encouraged me to interview Dr. Harris because they were chronically ill for a long time and no one could diagnose what was going on. And then along came this test that is able to pick up this infection after it's been present in the body for a very, very long time. So, Dr. Harris, can you explain why it's complex when time has passed to test for this?
Well, what often happens is over time, and let me just back up and say, probably every patient makes the full complement of antibodies when they're infected, but over time, they're going to lose antibodies. So you may look at a patient and using the standard tests that are available, and they won't have enough antibodies to trigger the Western blot. And even if they trigger the Western blot, the way most of the laboratories run them today is based on the fact that the test was designed for early Lyme. So It looks for really strong antibodies, but not all the antibodies.
Okay,
that are
so
going
the first test that most doctors have used for quite a while is called
ELISA.
Well, are there not two tests? Are they the same as the ELISA?
A tighter test, but that's pretty much out of the marketplace now.
So ELISA and Western blot are working on the same system.
Both working on antibodies, but the ELISA is kind of a looks for the total amount of antibodies to the Lyme bacteria. So there's a lot of false positives, but the test isn't set up sensitive enough to even find 100% of the patients early after an infection. So it's a bad screening test. We wouldn't use it for another test, but it's used for Lyme. So our laboratory skips the ELISA unless a physician wants it, and offers a very sensitive Western blot that was designed to look at patients during all phases of disease.
So Western blot can be ordered after some time. See, one of the things that we're talking about here is there are tests that are used. Someone comes in, they say, I found a tick, and you can test the tick. They test, it's a Lyme tick. It's a tiny, one of those little tiny poppy seed ticks. And they have a bullseye rash. These are very lucky people because it's very easy to figure this out, and some people don't present this way. And then there's, if I understand it right, there are some tests that you can do right away, but if you don't get it right away, then you have to do different tests. Are you saying actually you can use any of these, you know, the tests that you've developed even early on?
You can use them even early on. Probably the earliest for an antibody test is about 3 or 4 weeks. But there's DNA tests and antigen tests that can be used much earlier if the patient has clinical symptoms.
Okay, so your lab is doing more than one test on someone who...
We do a lot of different tests.
Okay, and they're all looking at...
We're all looking at different aspects of the Lyme bacteria.
Yeah.
We're also looking at some of the other bacteria that are carried by the tick that infect about 20% of the patients that are infected with Lyme.
So as you were saying, one of the complexities of this, aside from timing, is this issue of misdiagnosis and false positives?
False positives, but also even worse is false negatives. That many patients that have had symptoms for a long time, they're going to be missed by many laboratories. And it's estimated that we miss on a yearly basis about 80% of the patients that we find. It's the reporting is tenfold underreported. So instead of reporting 200,000 patients a year being infected with Lyme, we're reporting 20,000 patients.
Now, when you say we, you don't mean...
Meaning the government.
Okay.
And all the groups that are reporting, because Lyme is a reportable disease.
Can you explain what it is that your tests are looking for? I mean, you said one is antibody. You're looking for these traces of an immune response to...
We're looking for the patient's ability to make an antibody to some of the major antigens of this Lyme bacteria.
Right, so the body's response. And then you said that you can also look for DNA?
You can also look for the presence of the DNA of the organism. It's a very sensitive technique.
The
problem with it, it works much better in viral diseases because with HIV or hepatitis, most of the cells of the body are infected, so it's much easier to find it. In Lyme disease, you have to find the right tissue. If someone has a swollen joint, it becomes a really good target to look with a DNA test, or if someone has a skin lesion, you can do a biopsy and look for the DNA. But if you just take some blood, it may not be in the blood that day.
Yes. You were saying that one of the difficulties is educating the medical public, you know, the medical community, and that there's this terrible division between doctors about and practitioners about what to do, how to test. So educating the medical community has been difficult. Can you explain what the divisions are about?
Well, there's two major groups. There is the ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society of physicians, and that's a group that I belong to. It's made up of community-based physicians all over the country, and in fact, it's a worldwide organization. And then you have the academic-based Infectious Disease Society, and both groups have treatment guidelines. Basically, the ILADS guidelines say you treat the patient till they get better. The Infectious Disease Society primarily says Lyme is very easy to treat. 3 or 4 weeks of antibiotics are sufficient. So these groups have set up. There's major differences that we've tried to get together with the Infectious Disease Society to kind of work out these differences, but that has not happened yet.
So, Dr. Harris, you've been looking at this disease for a long time. Are you feeling as though there's a kind of epidemic quality to this now? Because there's been a lot of alarm about this lately. There are people who believe that it's becoming contagious, that it's carried in saliva and bodily fluids, that family members are picking it up. I have to think that you're involved in some of the research with the etiology of this disease. What are you seeing in terms of trends?
Well, we are. I've been interested in Lyme disease since 1977 and running labs for it since the mid-1980s. And because more people are becoming aware of the disease, we're seeing that a lot of patients that have had diseases such as chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, now their physicians are realizing that maybe it was Lyme disease that they're starting to test.
Mm-hmm.
And when they find a positive patient, that patient in most cases can be successfully treated and managed.
Even after years?
Even after many, many years.
Wow, well that's really, that is very good news. You know, Cindy, you and I talked a bit about this whole business of why it's becoming such a, it's being so noticed now, and this kind of scary thing about, oh, people think it's, family members are picking it up from each other, and we don't know the answer to that. So on the one hand, we have this scary feeling like, here's this tiny little tick that you really almost can't see on your body, unless you, you know, you sort of spray paint yourself white or something. And there's this sense that everybody that's chronically ill maybe has Lyme. You're on the forefront of treating people with chronic illnesses. What percentage of your population are Lyme positive?
Well, I
don't need an exact number.
I couldn't give you an exact percentage of my practice, but what I can say is one of the reasons that I'm seeing a lot more of Lyme patients in my community is because most of the other doctors in my medical community do not treat chronic Lyme disease. They are feel as though that it can be treated very quickly with a short course of antibiotics, and only if someone does come in to see them with a rash or is known to have had a tick bite. So I'm seeing more and more of patients with Lyme disease because people know in the community that I'm willing to address their concerns and test for it and treat them as necessary.
It's it may be important also to remind people that Lyme is named Lyme because it was first noticed in Connecticut. And it seems to be prevalent in areas, you know, obviously it grows in East Coast forests, it thrives, it lives, it's a deer tick. Although other ticks can also carry other invasive illnesses and bacteria, this particular tiny little guy also shows up in a lot in California. It tends to like to hang out in grass, so it's never a good idea to go storming up a hillside that's with dry grass, you know, with a pair of shorts on. People have probably read about tucking your pants into your socks and examining yourself after a walk and spraying yourself with various substances, some of them natural, some of them more chemical. What sorts of precautions are you now practicing maybe for yourself since seeing patients and seeing what this can do if it's left untreated?
Well, I think it's mostly practical precautions. I mean, when you're outside or if you're hiking, you know, the best clothing would be to wear long sleeve, long pants, light-colored, loose-fitting clothing and a hat, to be constantly, you know, checking your clothes. And when you come in from outside, they recommend that you remove your clothes and put them in a hot dryer for up to an hour, you know, hopefully to kill any ticks that could be residing on the clothes. Pets oftentimes will bring in ticks, so you need to check them often and maybe consider using a tick repellent on them as well.
Yeah, there are some substances. Now, first of all, my experience living in the woods myself and hiking, there's no way that I'm actually going to walk around wearing long sleeves and long pants in warm weather and a hat all the time and do a hot dryer. It's just, you know, I think for most people, unless they've been bitten once, they're not going to take those precautions. They may just examine themselves very carefully afterwards and get used to noticing it. The other thing is that there are some essential oils that do, I noticed a article, I think in New Scientist magazine, the British magazine, that lemon eucalyptus, which is not lemon and eucalyptus, but a form of eucalyptus, a type of eucalyptus, lemon eucalyptus, works as well in studies at deterring the tick as does DEET, which is a far more irritating substance for people. But it can be put on the back of your pet's neck to deter some of this if they'll tolerate it. They won't like you very much when you do it. You can also put it on your clothing, on your socks, a little bit of around. We're going to need to take a brief break. When we come back, I want to talk to Cindy some more about the difference in how you treat different people, the fact that people will want different types of treatments. So far, we've only been sort of using long-term antibiotics for this, and it might be interesting to explore what else is available to people. So you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm talking to Cindy Quattro, Q-U-A-T-T-R-O, and Dr. Nick Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S. Nick Harris is at Igenix Lab, and their website is igenix.com. Cindy Quattro has a private practice in the Santa Cruz area of California. I don't know whether you want to give out a number or not.
Yes, it would be 831-476-1886.
One more time.
831-476-1886.
So we'll be back with more about Lyme. Please stay with us.
Along with us to the glorious annual Ugly Bug Ball. Come on, let's crawl to the Ugly Bug Ball. And a happy time we'll have there, one and all at the Ugly Bug Ball. While the crickets click their tricky melodies, all the ants were fancy dancing with the fleas. Then up from under the ground, the worms came squirming around. Oh, they danced until their legs were nearly lame. Every little crawling creature you can name, everyone was glad. What a time they had. They were so happy they came. Come on, let's crawl. Gotta crawl, gotta crawl to the Ugly Bug Ball, to the ball, to the ball.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm doing a show today called, I have to find exactly what I called it, Lyme, Why, Whether, and What to Do. I'm on the phone with Cindy Quattro, Q-U-A-T-T-R-O, in the Santa Cruz area of California, and Dr. Nick Harris from Igenix Lab, igenix.com. We're talking about Lyme. If you missed parts of today's show, you can go to the website and listen to it all week at yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you'll also find information about our speaking schedule and information on how to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, or you can call 707-874-2772. So, Cindy, I'm actually calling you Cindy because you have one of those series of degrees that doesn't give you a doctor yet, but you're close to becoming one. Soon we'll be able to say Dr. Quattro.
Cindy is fine.
You know, what occurs to me with treating people, because I see this in my own health education practice, that when you look at which treatment option, part of it is going to be what their immune system is like and what they'll tolerate, what their body will tolerate, because you don't want to make someone worse while you're getting them better. But the other thing is that I would think that a person's values about treatment would also be important to consider.
Yes, I think working as a team with my patients makes me a unique practitioner, and I think that's why we call it complementary medicine, because we like to complement one another. That's one theory of why we call it complementary. I do like to take the time to let my patients tell me their story and let me know what's really going on, what their priority of symptoms are, and where to start in terms of treatment.
So what would make you decide, would there ever be a decision made not to use antibiotics with Lyme?
Yes, there are decisions made.
Give me some examples of when that might work not to use, because I know some people would really prefer not, because a long antibiotic treatment, no matter how much you take probiotics and things to soothe the gut, does do damage to the mucosal lining of the gut. It's just hard not to have that happen. So when would you not use antibiotics with Lyme?
Well, for instance, if I have a young, healthy, vibrant person that comes in, has been bitten by a tick, and we do the watch and wait, perhaps. I would do testing as soon as it's appropriate to do the testing. If the testing comes back negative, then they're perhaps off of a treatment plan until further notice. I may use nutritional supplements that are known to help with treating Lyme, such as some of the herbal remedies, as sort of an insurance. However, I do continue to test, and if there are signs that the test does show a positive result, then we discuss antibiotics again.
Well, it is the case that Lyme will often sit and wait for something like 10 years before presenting with symptoms. Is that not right?
I think in a vibrant, healthy immune person, I think it doesn't take that long. I think the immune system will show symptoms. I think it's the immune-deficient people that have trouble really mounting an immune response.
That makes sense. So can you give us an example of, I mean, you're about to become a doctor of Oriental medicine. You're about to get a doctorate in this field of traditional Chinese medicine. you're looking at a disease that causes certain types of imbalances. And I don't know whether we're looking at something that affects the heating and the cooling, the alkalinizing or the acidification of a patient, or, I mean, if it's causing metabolic syndrome and it's causing neurotoxic effects, I have to think that there would be a particular kind of approach to enhancing the body's immune response to it.
Yes, well, I've been studying Chinese medicine for a long time, and I'm still studying it. And one of the things I'm most intrigued with is that besides it addressing the eradication of a toxin, it also helps to support the immune system or what is good at the same time. So we can combine treatments, combine formulas, herbal formulas, or use acupuncture to treat both in both directions.
And when you try to enhance the immune system, is that going to be an individual situation? Is it going to vary, or are there some things that you can anticipate using in all people who have been exposed? I mean, you're talking about healthy individuals. That's a pretty rare case that healthy individual. I mean, a healthy individual might just go ahead and do a single series of doxycycline and be finished with it, but I think that the people who have the most trouble are the ones who are not so simple and really get kind of sick.
Yes, there's all sorts of herbal combinations. In Chinese medicine, we look at the constitution of the person and we look to see which areas are most efficient. Typically, the immune system is associated with the kidneys in Chinese energetic terms, so we do use herbs that focus on that area.
Okay, and what sorts of nutritional interventions are you trying?
So then in terms of nutrition, as far as treating the Lyme disease itself, we look at things like the cat's claw as a useful antimicrobial. And we look at other remedies, such as colloidal silver has been known to be a good antimicrobial. I mean, these are things that we would use adjunctively and not necessarily by themselves.
Artemisia has been getting a lot of blah, blah. People have been talking a lot about using artemisia with this, and there's been some controversy about whether or not it's a good formula to, well, it's not a formula, a single herb to use.
Well, artemisia is used more specifically towards one of the co-infections of Lyme, and that's Babesia. There's been a lot of studies showing that artemisia does help to treat malaria, and Babesia being a similar type of organism. And the idea of treating Babesia with artemisia has been promoted. However, we don't have specific studies to show that it will cure Babesia.
Now, silver, colloidal silver, is a little bit tricky because it does cause a healing crisis in some people. I think it's pretty often that that happens. So how do you, I mean, I tried some silver recently after a bout with an intestinal flu, and I got a Herzheimer effect from it that was pretty awful, and I was kind of cautious with it. So how do you work with silver? I find it kind of tricky.
Well, I find these patients are going through Herzheimer's often from different treatments.
These are healing crises.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we address it just like we would address any other Herzheimer response or healing crisis, and that perhaps could be using more vitamin C or other remedies that just help to for them to detoxify more efficiently.
So is the problem when you're getting a Herzheimer effect that you're not detoxifying very well? Is that your understanding?
I think so. I think they're in the detoxification process, yes.
Well, but that's different than saying they're not detoxifying well. In other words, is the issue, I mean, a lot of times people just say back off and reduce the dose, but if we're looking at a detoxification problem, then we can look at things like other herbs or other vitamins that might improve elimination, for instance, so that they can remove the silver or whatever. If it's how does the silver work? Is it working by actually killing things, or is it attracting them and driving them out of the body?
My understanding is it is an antimicrobial, sort of like an antibiotic itself.
Yeah,
and it's individual as far as the person that we tell them to stop the remedy because they're having a Herx response, or we tell them to continue and just add something in to help support them. It depends on the state of that person.
And then there are things like people report with all kinds of situations where they're trying to move something out of their body that using something like an infrared sauna in conjunction with things that help to kill the organism, the way to kind of get the dead creatures out of your body, because those might be causing an inflammatory response or an allergic response, that, you know, using a sauna, an infrared sauna, which heats you from the inside, might be useful. Do you hear anything about that?
Yes.
Or you'd use the saunas? Do you have any preference one way or the other? I always worry about the sauna with the heaters creating a lot of electromagnetic fields, and I wonder whether, you know, there's also the lamps, using the lamps. Do you?
I recommend the infrared saunas for those that want to detoxify more quickly.
And what about the electromagnetic fields from the heaters? Do you prefer the lamps to the heaters?
I like the heaters themselves, the saunas.
So you don't worry about the electromagnetic fields there?
No.
Okay. And the other thing I'm wondering about here is that we're dealing with, I mean, we're talking about speeding up detoxification pathways, trying to get the body to move this stuff out, particularly because the neurotoxins that the spirochetes produce tend to cause the detoxification pathways to actually be impaired because of what it does to the liver. So I have to think you're using various things to support the detox pathways and the liver itself.
Yes, we have lots of nutrients in that way. And for instance, the alpha-lipoic acid is a often used supplement that is fat and water soluble, so it does tend to cleanse the cells inside the cells and extracellularly as well.
And what about vitamin C? How about like an IV of vitamin C, for instance?
Perhaps a vitamin C drip could be indicated for that person. Also, any way to help improve glutathione, increase glutathione, and that would even be the whey powder protein. That's been shown to enhance immunity significantly.
How does the whey powder enhance immunity? It's basically just highly processed protein. Is it because there's some sulfur-containing aminos in there?
No, it has immunoglobulins in the whey powder.
So you could also conceivably use bovine immunoglobulins or even colostrum, I would think, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things, this is...
Dr. Harris.
One of the things to keep in mind is that things like colloidal silver, there's been a lot of studies. It's really hard to prove that they have any benefit in vitro. That means growing the bacteria in tissue culture. You don't find the toxicity at any level that would be safe in the human body. That a lot of supplements are just that. They're supplemental to the allopathic treatment, which is using antibiotics. And I think the majority of the people that use our laboratory are physicians who have some really, really sick patients that need the antibiotics. And I appreciate the use of the homeopathic and neutral pharmaceuticals in those patients that can accept antibiotics, but antibiotics should not be thrown out.
Oh, no. No, I don't think that they should be thrown out either. It's just that there are people... I mean, what I see in my own practice, just to give you some, and I'm an educator, so I'm really just basically giving people information, but what I might recommend to them to think about is I've seen people come to my office who have been on long-term antibiotic therapy, and without sufficient support for the rest of their system, their gastrointestinal system starts to collapse, and they start to get other problems.
I agree with you entirely.
So it's very, and if you've got somebody who's in fragile shape, even doxycycline, which is has a kind of anti-inflammatory effect, it's a very nice antibiotic for that reason, is going to be long term very irritating. So I think the reason that people look at things like, I incidentally wasn't sure what you were saying about the silver. It sounded like you were saying it does in fact kill.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, you don't think it does when you use it in a petri dish. It doesn't kill it. Okay. So of course there are a lot of antibiotic herbs too, like black walnut, wormwood and artemisium and
right.
olive leaf and all that. But you know, my own sense of this is that, as Cindy has said, you kind of have to form the treatment around the patient. And I think it's very useful to hear, Dr. Harris, what you've seen in terms of just straight immunology. Although, of course, what we also know is that things that happen in a petri dish is not the same as what happens in a live human organism, because there's a melange of other substances in the body at the same time. In a petri dish, not so, but I think it's still useful. You know, it's like an Ames test, you know, to see mm-hmm. what does. What I'm concerned with is that people are supported in using a variety of therapies, not to throw out one therapy over another, but that they use a combination of things so that, particularly in a very fragile patient, they're not pushed into a crisis by the treatment.
I agree with you entirely. I think the best practitioners are those that partake in both camps.
Another thing to consider here is the issue of, well, actually, let me just quickly ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Cindy Quattro, PA and LAC, and Dr. Nick Harris from Igenix Lab. We're talking about Lyme. Another thing that seems to happen to Lyme patients that I think is often not discussed or dealt with is this issue of this metabolic syndrome-like effect where diet suddenly becomes very important because they seem to be developing a high blood sugar kind of stress reaction. And in those cases, rich protein sources, a good supply of undamaged fats, low-carbohydrate diet seems to be, from what I've seen, talking to Lyme patients and also what I've seen in my own practice, seems to help a lot, that avoiding sugar and wheat and allergic foods, drinking lots of water, that kind of a simple intervention in terms of diet can make a tremendous difference in the status of these people.
Yeah, that's been reported to me a lot.
Yeah.
And in fact, the question is, are some of the patients with symptoms of thyroid disease, is it
yes.
primary or is it caused by the Lyme bacteria? We know that when you treat the Lyme, it goes away.
Wow. That's very interesting.
I don't know what came first, and did the Lyme affect the thyroid or vice versa?
Well, we are seeing a real epidemic of thyroid diseases. I think there's more than one reason for that to happen. Are you saying that these are people who present with a thyroid problem, but they don't have the other symptoms of Lyme? Or are you saying that they've got the full complement?
They have the full complement.
Yeah,
of Lyme.
So you wouldn't think that,
that.
Yeah, not just anybody who has a thyroid problem should immediately get away tested.
And I think thyroid has an impact on the immune system, so perhaps
very much.
Those people would be more susceptible to contracting Lyme if they had low thyroid to start with. I always recommend an anti-inflammatory diet, which I think is similar to a lot of these diets, and especially because of the fungal overgrowth that can take place when people are on antibiotics long-term. And with a diet that is low in carbohydrates, that will help to prohibit the continual growth of candida.
Yeah, and I think it is possible to re-add probiotics, to add the Acidophilus and Bifidus. It's just very important to take these very far from the dose of antibiotic, because essentially, if you take them at the same time, the antibiotic is going to be working on your probiotic instead of your beasts that are in your body.
I'm not sure how helpful the probiotics are for that very reason, but I do recommend prebiotics, which are the nutrients that help to support the good bacteria in the intestine. There's something that's derived from a yeast called Saccharomyces boulardii.
Yeah, that's fine if you're not allergic to Bruges yeast, although I think a lot of people are. But again, some of the, I don't know, I think people can experiment with it. My experience has been that you can use a probiotic, you just have to take it far away from the other, from the dose of antibiotic. But that's certainly a consideration. If people can handle the Saccharomyces, that would be a good way to go. I think some exercise is probably important in these patients as well to promote some of this detox. And I would think that things like Qigong and yoga and Tai Chi would be really important as well.
Yes, I think a form of an energetic effect in the healing is important. And I think that's where, like you said, Lena, yoga or Qigong or acupuncture would come in there and help to balance that part of the body.
Cindy, have you seen good effects with the various mushrooms like the cordyceps?
Yes, I use cordyceps regularly in my practice.
And are there some people who can't tolerate cordyceps? Mushrooms always seem like a fairly complex thing. Some people react to mushrooms. What happens if you've got somebody who's sensitive to mushrooms? Is there a way around it?
I haven't seen anyone react to cordyceps.
Okay.
I think the therapeutic mushrooms are a little different than the commercially grown mushrooms.
So you don't see gastrointestinal symptoms with it, huh?
I haven't.
No. Okay. And then there are people who are resorting to some rather unconventional things that I've heard people just swear works. Like there's something called a Rife machine, which is an electromagnetic therapy. Of course, as soon as I hear the words electromagnetic, I kind of reel backwards since I don't like to expose people to excess amounts of that. But has anybody seen any studies on the Rife?
I've read the history on the Rife, and it's a very intriguing history. It's really hard to do studies. And I've heard from patients both ways. Most of the physicians don't really get involved with it.
No, I'm sure physicians don't. Cindy, have you seen anything about it?
I've seen studies for it and against it as far as treatment effects.
So what would be the caution for somebody who's attracted to it?
Well, if you look at the machine, and I did buy one to study it, the tube that's used looks very similar to an old X-ray tube. So the question would be to make sure that when you're generating the frequencies that there's no X-rays or harmful, you know, rays that come out that do more harm than good.
Yeah, and I would be cautious about it simply because bombarding people with electromagnetic fields has never been shown long-term to be a good idea. Let's go back to hormonal therapies for a moment. We talked about thyroid. Thyroid patients who are low in thyroid are usually low also in DHEA and sometimes in the antigens like testosterone. So I would think that testing, especially for someone who's been sick for a long time, that testing the hormones and delicately replacing them to a physiologic level might also be supportive to healing.
I think that's integral to the treatment, yes. I look at all the hormones.
And what trends do you see? Do you see the DHEA going down? Do you see other trends?
Yes, I oftentimes will see the DHEA low, testosterone low, thyroid low. Those are the most common deficiencies. And then depending on the woman's age, we may look at the reproductive hormones too.
Well, in men as well, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
What about this issue of people who have chronic illnesses tend to get clotty. Their blood gets coagulates more. They get clotty. So you've got the issues of clotting factors. I would think, again, that along with looking at the detox pathways, and there you would be looking at B12, B6, folic acid, and there are some folic acids that dissolve under the tongue. I know intensive nutrition makes one that in San Leandro that is dissolved under the tongue, which is a good carrier for folic acid. It's a higher dose. That because the detox pathways are inhibited, the B6, B12, and folic acid should be added back. I'm thinking also that for some patients, trimethylglycine or betaine would also be useful. Not everybody can take it, but people who react well to it should probably also consider that.
For blood that may be clotting too much, I tend to move into the direction of treatment with enzymes, ones that thin the blood, you know, such as the natokinase. And there's also a product that is originally derived from earthworms, the enzymes that earthworms make. And this has a powerful effect on thinning, not only thinning the blood, but also acting as an anti-inflammatory.
You're saying that you think that TMG clots the blood?
No, saying that some people with Lyme may have clotting issues.
Yes.
And I'm saying the way that more specifically is with the enzymes.
Right. And then turmeric is also good, curcumin. And then that's another place where getting the hormones balanced between the estrogens and the testosterone in both sexes, getting the androgens back in and progesterone to balance the clotty effects there too. I'm trying to think of what else would be important here. I know that people are attracted to a lot of very, very strong herbs. I always worry about the gut, so I would always think that when people are using very strong antibacterial herbs that maybe they cycle them. Does that sound right, Cindy?
Yes, you can cycle them. In Chinese medicine, we don't just give one herb, and we always balance it for that person's constitution. So if they have a weak digestive system, then they're also taking herbs that help to regulate the digestion. For instance, orange peel would be a typical herb that would be in a formula to help to regulate the digestion.
Orange peel is a little bit acidic, but the bioflavonoids in it, is that what we're saying?
Well, when it comes to describing the herbs in the Chinese sense, they're not looking at the chemical component as much as the effect that it has on the person that's been studied for thousands of years. So they may use orange peel. They may use licorice.
Licorice is wonderful, and it's an antiviral too.
Yes. So it's always in a combination.
Yeah.
But pulsing not only antibiotics, but herbal antibiotics is useful.
And then I would think that if necessary, you could also use some glutamine to coat the gut and maybe even DGL licorice, particularly because DGL licorice doesn't seem to have as much of a hormonal effect, and possibly for people who are susceptible to losing potassium when they take licorice, that taking the deglycerized version, the DGL licorice, would be useful. It also appears that lime produces tumor necrosing factors, so it would be useful to maybe add some ginger in, too. I mean, it sounds like some of these Chinese formulas do just that.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts, Dr. Harris, in terms of, I realize that your approach to lime may be more conventional in the terms of long-term doxycycline use, and I guess to that end you've had to advocate for that because a lot of people don't.
One of the things that I've seen over the past few years where a lot of the ILADS physicians have been having success is by using multiple antibiotics with supplements at the same time. In the early 1990s, it was more of a monotherapy, and we weren't very good at treating Lyme patients. And I think we've learned a lot since that time.
So you mean you've become more sensitized to the need for combining things instead
combining
of
combining things, I think, is a major change that's started to happen in the field, combining both multiple antibiotics and nutraceuticals.
Okay. Well, we're just about running out of time. Cindy, if you could give out your phone number again.
My office phone number is 831-476-1886.
And Dr. Harris, your website again.
Is igenex.com.
I want to thank you both for joining us today. Cindy Quattro and Dr. Nick Harris, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, and notices about our public health education courses and tickets to them, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, Your Own Health and Fitness with Anne spelled out. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness today is Simin Yohaki. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.